Jack, the gentlest of men, began losing his temper. Janet, normally easygoing, showed anxiety when the smallest part of her household routine went wrong. Between themselves, they'd even wondered once if the girls might not be playing tricks on them, which could explain some of the odd events. But almost immediately, they rejected the idea, knowing that while the girls were occasionally mischievous, they would not do things that would upset or worry their parents this way. The Smurls were still the strong, loving parents they'd always been, but obviously they were preoccupied with the visitor and the other related incidents. But as gray February became sunny March, boding well for an early spring, Jack and Janet returned to their former selves. Jack got his promotion at the plant, Janet received an award for all her service work with the Lionesses, and the girls got involved in various athletic endeavors, everything from basketball to volleyball to swimming. One night during this peaceful time, Janet and Jack were sitting up watching the late news on television when Janet said,
"Do you suppose it's over?"
She did not have to define for Jack what it was. "I'm almost afraid to say it, but I think it is," Jack said, and smiled. "I think the spooks got themselves a room at the Holiday Inn." Earnestly, she said,
"You really believe it's over?"
"I really do."
"And you're not just saying that?"
"I'm not just saying that." That spring, Kim Smurl was 13 years old, the age at which most Roman Catholic children are confirmed. The confirmation process is one through which the participant becomes aware, in an adult way, of the tenets and responsibilities of being a good Catholic. In some respects, it is like the bar mitzvah of the Jewish religion. The ceremony was scheduled for a weeknight evening, which meant there was a great deal of rushing around in the house. Janet Smurl had made dinner, pressed Kim's white confirmation dress, talked to Shannon about a test she'd only gotten a C on, and finally corralled Kim long enough to pin a special collar on her special dress. This was in the kitchen.
"You know how things are when you're rushed," Janet Smurl recounts. "Kim and I were in the middle of the kitchen, and Shannon was standing off to the right, over by the refrigerator. And that's when it happened."
As she worked on her daughter's dress, a massive tearing sound, as if something had ripped through a wall, filled the kitchen. Before there was time to move, Janet glanced up to see the heavy ceiling light they'd installed 7 years ago when they'd remodeled their home come crashing down amidst sputtering electrical blinking and powdery ceiling dust. Janet and the girls screamed and tried to get out of the light's way. Janet and Kim were fortunate. They managed to get under the kitchen table. But before Kim could pull her sister to safety, Shannon was struck on the shoulder by the 4-foot-long ceiling light as it crashed to the floor. By now, Jack, who had been getting ready upstairs, had come racing into the kitchen, terrified by what he'd heard. Kim and Shannon were sobbing. Janet was examining Shannon to determine the extent of her injury.
"My God," Jack Smurl said, looking up at where the light had been.
He knew that it had been properly fitted there and securely bolted. But now there was just a ragged hole showing white plaster and the entrails of black electrical wiring that curved thickly like snakes and hung exposed. Janet's mind was fixed on the moment that light had fallen within 2 inches of Shannon's head. If the girl had been struck by it directly, she would have been killed. Shannon could have been dead. Quickly, the Smurls got their daughters ready to pile into the van and drive to Immaculate Conception Church for confirmation. They were already running seriously behind time. On the way out the door, the children going on ahead of them, Janet Smurl glanced at Jack. No words were necessary to convey what she was feeling. The terror. Jack pulled her to him and kissed her gently on the cheek.
"It'll be all right, babe."
Huddled into him, she closed her eyes and allowed herself the luxury of a shiver.
"I'm really scared."
By this time, Janet knew enough about the supernatural to know that sanctified events and objects made demons particularly angry. What could be more sanctified than confirmation? Janet's eyes rose to the ugly hole where the light fixture had been. Aloud, she prayed to the Lord Jesus that whatever might happen to her and Jack, the children would not be hurt. Then Janet felt the stirrings of a new feeling as well, the beginning of cold hatred for the presence that was filling their house. It had now tried to hurt one of her children. Janet.
"After that, we spent hours, days, weeks, talking to people who might possibly be able to help us. But I have to say that most of the people we mentioned this to took a very condescending attitude. For instance, I called several universities all over the country that had departments dealing with either parapsychology or paranormal phenomena, but surprisingly, they weren't much help at all. I remember one especially bad experience where the professor, in a haughty tone, asked me if I watched a lot of horror movies, implying that I'd just let my imagination run away with me. I just couldn't believe it.
Jack's Nightmare. Near the end of April, Jack and Janet Smurl packed their camper with kids and various supplies and set off to one of the campgrounds where, on weekends, they relaxed and enjoyed their leisure time. The spring-like weather had continued through April. Apple blossoms scenting the air, grass stretching like a green ocean up the rolling foothills of the region. After the ceiling light had injured Shannon, Jack and Janet began to see the true dimensions of their problem. While as yet they did not believe in hauntings as such, they had come to understand that some unnatural force was working within the walls of their home. What it was, or what motivated it, remained a mystery. All the Smurls knew was that on this sunny weekend they wanted to escape its clutches, so they headed for the camping ground. Chase Street is, in the best sense, a real neighborhood. The people who live there watch out for each other. When a family goes out of town, the other neighbors keep at least a casual eye on the empty house, making sure that nothing happens to it. The weekend the Smurls left, several neighbors checked on the house, saw that everything appeared to be all right, and then went on to their own homes. Just after dark on Saturday night, however, several neighbors heard something that still frightens them. A neighbor who requests that his name not be used says, "I've never heard anybody scream as they were dying. But I imagine that the sound I heard coming from the Smurls' home must sound very much like that. The way people must have sounded in concentration camps or something. I was walking past the Smurls' home when I heard this very strange fluttering sound coming from the second-story window, like giant birds flapping their wings or something. Then the screaming started and it was real scary. My wife went on home ahead of me. She was too frightened to stay once the screaming began. Like I say, you would have thought somebody was being axed to death or something inside that house. But we knew that it was empty, that the Smurls were out of town." This was the first time the neighborhood at large became aware of the problems the Smurls were having with their house. Unfortunately, several other neighbors would later understand all too well. Three of the girls needed school clothes. They were at the age when they seemed to outgrow their entire wardrobe in the space of 6 months. Tonight, on this warm May evening, Janet decided to take all four of the girls to the Insalico Shopping Center near the southern edge of town. Jack, tired from the day's work and feeling that he might be coming down with the flu, said he would just stay home and probably go to bed early. He took a paperback biography of John Wayne upstairs with him and laid down. The time was 7:14. Reading proved to be the perfect sleeping potion because after only 3 pages, the paperback fell to his chest and Jack promptly went to sleep. As a boy, Jack had often had dreams of falling from tall buildings. He could still recall the sensation of being suspended in air and then crashing toward the pavement below. He always awoke with a start, his heart pounding hard in his chest. Tonight, he had the sensation of being suspended in air, but not of falling. It was as if he were literally lying on the air currents, comfortable and tranquil. Only gradually did Jack begin to realize that he was not, in fact, dreaming. There was the sound of cars going by in the street outside. There was the aroma of spring flowers through the open window. There was the feel of his clothing against his flesh. Suddenly, he opened his eyes and saw that he was not dreaming at all. He was levitating, lying perfectly still, 2 feet above his bed. His first reaction was panic. He started to move, to thrash around, trying to sit up right there in the middle of the air. It was then that the thing hurled him back onto the bed. He jumped from the bed and stood with his hands clenched into fists, shouting, "Show yourself! Show yourself!" But there was just his own hammering heart, and the peculiar, mocking silence. He had become a plaything for the entity loose in this house. And at this moment, he was more afraid than he ever had been in his life. Interview with Jack Smurl. Did you have any inkling at this point that things were only going to get worse?
Not really. Look, I'm a family man in my 40s. I've had a very normal background. When I was a boy, my dad used to take us swimming, and I played basketball, and I hung out at the Catholic Youth Center, especially on the nights when they had dances there. You know, lots of Elvis and Johnny Mathis and Nat King Cole records. Then I did my hitch in the Navy. In those days, you called a short hitch like mine a kitty cruise. And then I got out and got married and had a family.
So you're saying that you didn't have anything in your background to prepare you for this?
Exactly.
So you didn't have any idea of what to make of it?
No, and I'd argue that most people wouldn't. The first thing the average person does is reject the idea that he's dealing with the supernatural. All these things happen to you, really incredible things, but your mind keeps looking for some normal explanation, you know?
So at this point, you rejected the possibility that you were dealing with the supernatural.
No, I didn't reject it. I just hoped some other explanation would come along. But of course, when I sat down and really thought about it, black forms that walked through walls and light fixtures that fell down and nearly killed my daughter, what other explanation could there be?
So deep down you knew you were dealing with the supernatural, but you kept trying to deny it.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. It was this whole denial process. Only as things kept happening, it was harder and harder to keep saying it's not supernatural, because no other explanation was possible. Not a one.
Statement of Shelley Adams, age 23.
I've lived down the street from the Smurls for 7 years, and my parents are two of Janet and Jack's best friends. Most of our neighborhood became aware of what was going on at the Smurl house after the weekend when the screaming was heard by several nearby residents. After that, Janet and Jack were much more forthright in discussing the problems they were having with those of us who lived nearby. At first, I admit, I was very skeptical. Though I consider myself a religious person, I see many occult and supernatural occurrences as either tricks of some kind by publicity seekers or the mind playing tricks on itself. But because so many things were happening to the Smurls, I saw the possibility that paranormal things could happen, even right on my own block. As for the Smurls themselves, all of us could see the strain this was putting on them. Sometimes Janet and Jack would bicker a bit, and we'd never seen that before. And occasionally Jack would sort of snap at his daughters, who were really his pride and joy, so snapping at them was very uncharacteristic. Janet began to confide in my mother a great deal, and since I was still living at home, I was part of many conversations. Somehow, though, I believed that Janet believed everything she was saying. I still had reservations of my own. I guess I was still looking for some kind of natural explanation, even though, along with most of the other neighbors on West Chase Street, I was starting to see that any kind of natural explanation was highly unlikely. One afternoon after work, I came home and found Janet and my mother talking about how Janet's mother-in-law, Mary, had heard children laughing and running around in the Smurls' half of the duplex, even though none of the Smurls were there at the time. I guess that struck me as pretty humorous for some reason because I said, "Don't worry, Janet, I'll call the Ghostbusters and have them ghostbust the house for you." I could see instantly that I'd embarrassed my mother and hurt Janet's feelings. I quickly apologized and said, "I guess it isn't funny anymore, is it?" Janet's humor returned. "Maybe we should do what they used to in the movies, you know, offer you a big prize to stay in our house one night. Then I think you'd change your mind." "I really don't think I'd be afraid," I said confidently. Gently, Janet said, "I think you'd change your mind, Shelley." We had coffee and some home-baked chocolate chip cookies to go with it, and talked some more about all the strange things that had been happening at the Smurls, and then it was time for Janet to go start making the family dinner, and for my mother to go to her ceramic class, after which she'd met my father at a restaurant. I planned to stay around the house and wash the dishes. I stood at the top of the steps as my father and mother left. My father closed the front door and locked it. I then turned on the stereo and began to do the dishes. Not 5 minutes went by when the music, rock and roll, was so loud it hurt my ears. I went over to the radio and turned it back down, assuming there was a short in the radio wires. When I turned around, the front door was open about 2 or 3 inches. I walked down to it and saw the lock was still engaged. The presence or being that Janet had been talking about these past months was now in our house, too. I could feel it and sense it in the air, which had a peculiar texture, different somehow from what it usually was. And all I could think was that Janet had brought it with her. Then I did something that I shouldn't have done. I went to the phone, in tears and panic, and called Janet. I could hear my own voice, and even though I wanted to stop myself from saying such cruel words, I couldn't.
"You brought it with you. It is in our house now," I cried. "I don't want you to ever come here again, Janet."
My whole body shook, and I was sobbing from fear and confusion. Fortunately, Janet and I remained friends because she understood what I was going through. The awful things that terror can make you say to people. Just after the being had filled my own living room, there was another lull at the Smurls. You could see Janet and Jack becoming more relaxed again, and you could see this in the girls, too, because they'd been under a lot of strain also. When the neighbors talked now, it was with optimism. Maybe what had happened to the Smurls was coming to an end. Maybe the worst was behind us, and I say us because nearly the entire block was involved by this time, either in witnessing strange events or in trying to comfort and help the Smurls in their ordeal. But we were wrong. This was not the end. It was only the beginning.
The Violent Night. On a June evening of 1985, just after she had finished making love with her husband, Janet Smurl was pulled by some invisible fury from her bed and dragged across the floor. Janet.
Mostly, I just remember the sound of my own screaming. One moment, I'd been lying in Jack's arms, and the next, something I couldn't see had grabbed my right leg.
Jack. It was like a tug-of-war going on. I was holding on to her as hard as I could because I had no idea what the thing wanted to do to her. But the harder I tried to keep her next to me, the harder it pulled on her. Suddenly, Jack was paralyzed.
"Literally," he says, "I couldn't move. Something had seized control of me. I couldn't even curse the thing. I was totally immobilized."
Janet.
I held on to both Jack and the bedclothes. It was like clinging for my life on the edge of a cliff. I'd never felt more vulnerable, exposed the way I was in my life. I just kept screaming for help, but somehow I managed to stay on the bed.
Terrified to consider what might happen to her next, Janet was startled to find that the invisible force abruptly gave up. Janet.
I felt the pressure leave my leg. And then I saw Jack starting to move again. He put his hand out to me and I touched it. And that's when the banging started.
For more than a year, the Smurls had heard banging and pounding inside their walls, as if an army of demons was enraged. But it had never been as loud as it was tonight. Then the odor came, foul as a city dump on a steaming hot day, but twice as oppressive. Janet.
I began to gag, literally. And I could hardly breathe. I'd never been overpowered by an odor this way before.
Jack, the sounds and the odor really began to make me feel as if I was losing my mind. I was dizzy and sick, and I had this pounding headache. Somehow, I managed to get hold of Janet's hand, and we got out of there. It was like trying to escape from a burning building, only, in this case, the flames and the smoke were invisible. The pounding in the walls continued, as if the entity that had taken control of the house wanted to prove its dominance and mock them. During the next few days, Janet was uncharacteristically moody and quiet. A feeling of dread filled her, and no matter what she did, she could not rid herself of it, even when she thought back to her relatively carefree youth.
As a girl, Janet had been given to solitary walks through the countryside. She liked to roller skate and swim, and she spent many joyful hours in her room reading novels by the dozen, among them the Nancy Drew and Bobbsey Twins series. Later, in high school, her taste in books changed to bestsellers and incidents based on real history. It was at this time that she'd really bloomed, becoming both a majorette and a member of the Glee Club. She had fond memories of times following high school, her courtship with Jack and their early married years, even Karen being born with deformed vertebrae and virtually going in and out of the hospital every month at first had not sapped her strength the way the odd events on Chase Street did. Janet,
I started thinking about my past. You know how everything seems so much better in retrospect, so much easier. And I guess that's what scared me and made me so depressed. I felt that my family was being threatened by something we couldn't comprehend, let alone fight. It was very discouraging.
Since girlhood, Janet had been a fan of sitcoms. Everything from Abbott and Costello and Gilligan's Island in the old days to Mary Tyler Moore and Bob Newhart in more recent times. And so she tried over the next few days to spend as much time in front of the TV as possible, hoping to work herself into a better frame of mind. But none of her old standbys helped. There was just the gray, leaden skies and this terrible feeling that they were trapped in something they could never escape from. Continuing her tireless quest for help, Janet did two things during this period. She contacted the light company to see if they could explain why the lights were going on and off, and she wrote a letter to Channel 16 detailing what was going on in the Smurl household. The man who came from the light company and checked everything said that the house had been rewired only a few years ago, and that there were plenty of circuits, and that there would be no reason for lights going on and off. And as for the television station, not a word of response. Janet fell into one of her moods of isolation again. The assault. Psychologists know that stress can destroy family life. The increase in the national divorce rate attests to how right they are. These days, 50% of American marriages end in divorce. Imagine then the stress Janet and Jack Smurl and their family experienced as the invisible forces that had taken over their home conspired now to destroy it. Following the terrifying night in which Janet had been pulled from her bed by unseen hands, there ensued several weeks that tested the very foundation of the Smurl family. Janet,
there would be periods when we were obviously in some kind of true struggle with the powers that were trying to take over our home. We got in the habit of calling it. We didn't know any other name that would be appropriate. Anyway, one day I got so tired of being frightened that I got angry. I started screaming for it to leave my house and quit intimidating my family. I suppose I must have looked very strange, standing there shouting at something I couldn't even see. This was the day after Jack had his St. Jude medal taken from around his neck while he slept. It had to be lifted off because it doesn't have a clasp. We felt this was just the spirit trying to show us its superiority again, proving that it was our master. The next day would be one of the worst yet, because that was when it went after Simon.
Family friend. Simon is a big friendly dog who has been with the Smurl family since he was a puppy. He proves that not all German shepherds are violent. Each of the Smurl children has a favorite Simon story, some cute tale about the happy, protective dog as it grew to become a full-fledged member of the family. It was the dog's gentle nature that made what happened one Tuesday morning so infuriating. Janet was in the kitchen doing dishes. Simon sprawled out by her feet when suddenly she saw Simon lifted from the floor by invisible hands and smashed against the kitchen door. The dog howled in pain as it crashed to the floor. Janet dove for Simon, hugging him, trying to protect him from any more assaults. The big animal trembled and whimpered in her grasp. But that was not the only thing it had in mind for Simon. Soon after, Janet was in the kitchen, alone again with Simon, when she saw him abruptly buckle and begin to yelp in pain. His body then went into convulsive twitches, as if he were being flayed. The animal's fitful cries filled Janet's ears with pain, because she was unable to help the dog. Once more, all she could do was crouch next to Simon and hold him, and thereby keep the evil at bay. The Phantom Puppy. The dog that a few days later figured in the lives of Mary and John Smurl on the other side of the duplex was anything but a family friend. At night, the elderly couple liked to have a few snacks and watch television. On this particular evening, however, Mary was alone in the living room. John was in the kitchen repairing an appliance. Mary, engrossed in a show, noticed the strange sight only peripherally at first. Then her head snapped around and she felt her mouth drop open. A puppy, with neither a head nor a tail, ran across the room right in front of her and dashed under the love seat. Mary hurried to tell her husband, who immediately called for Jack to help him search for the phantom puppy. The pursuit went nowhere. The puppy was not to be found. Jack measured the space between love seat and floor, 1/2 inch. No puppy could go under there, Mom. No real puppy, Mary Smurl said, feeling a shiver travel the length of her spine. Then she thought of a remark she'd made earlier that evening. To her husband, she said, Remember how I said that the incidents had been tapering off? John Smurl nodded. I'll bet this is its way of proving that I was wrong, Mary Smurl said. Her husband and son believed she was right. The forces in the house seemed to take real delight in tormenting them. The children. Janet and Jack knew that for all the stress the haunting had put on them, the children were the ones who really suffered. You're a nice, normal girl. You like school, sports, music, and life with your family. You're proud of your parents and the kind of people they are, and you're proud of the part they play in the community. But over a period of less than 2 years, your life goes from the sunny days of an average childhood to the dark and brooding days of some very disturbing events. Do most children ever have to face the spectacle of pots and pans that fly around in the air of their own volition? Do most children ever have to face watching their pillow being punched violently by some invisible hand? Do most children ever have to face hearing eerie scratching, like something clawing inside the walls? The answer, obviously, is no. Yet the Smurl children were subjected to terrifying supernatural phenomena daily. Janet. One day I really lost my temper. Karen had been bothered in her room by this fluttering sound, the sound of huge birds taking flight, and it scared her so much she ran downstairs and into my arms. After I comforted her, I ran up the stairs and went into the twins' room and really threatened. You leave my children alone, damn it! I shouted. There were no more fluttering sounds that day. The children talked among themselves, of course, about the events plaguing their house. Dawn.
Some of it you could get used to, but some of it you just couldn't. The sound of fluttering wings, for example, is incredible. You get this image of gigantic birds taking off. One day we heard it in the chimney. My dad asked Kim to go outside and look on the roof. She didn't see anything, but we could still hear the fluttering, like something was trying to claw its way into the attic. It was horrible.
Kim.
One thing we learned about was the value of prayer. Lots of times it was real hard not to give in to despair, or not just sort of run out of the house crying. But we always found that prayer could calm us down and keep us from being confused and upset the way the spirits wanted us to be. We knew it wanted to break us up, and we just weren't going to let it.
But no matter how strong the Smurls' determination, there were moments when no amount of faith seemed sufficient to hold up under the demonic onslaught. Shannon's Fall. Like her twin sister, Karen, Shannon Smurl had always demonstrated creative abilities beyond her age. When she put Crayolas to coloring book, for instance, her work was impeccable. She also showed a knack for poetry and a talent for singing. Shannon, age 8, slept in the top bunk above her sister. One Thursday night during the early siege, she had been tucked into bed as usual by both parents and then fell quickly to sleep. A few hours later, Jack and Janet went to bed. They had been asleep for less than half an hour when they were awakened by a loud thudding noise, as if something very heavy had been dropped from the top of the stairs to the landing below. Startled, they then heard Shannon cry out in the darkness. Janet and Jack raced frantically down the steps, where they found their daughter slammed into the corner.
"Honey,"
Janet asked after they had determined that Shannon was all right physically,
"did you trip on the stairs?"
Jack thought this would be impossible. Both he and his wife were light sleepers. They would have heard Shannon's footsteps creaking on the old floors.
"I don't know. I don't know,"
Shannon said, weeping softly. They put her back in bed, said prayers by her bedside, and then checked on the other children, who were all right. Back in their own bed, Janet said,
"I won't stand for it anymore, Jack. We've got to find some help."
Jack agreed. He had been leery of occultists because of their tendency to be charlatans, but now he knew that something had to be done. His mind filled with an image of his daughter Shannon thrown down the stairs, crumpled at the bottom like a broken doll. He had no doubt of who had done this, or why. Once more, it wanted to prove its dominance. But Jack and Janet Smurl had very different thoughts in mind. In the morning, the search for guidance began in earnest. The search for help. The neighborhood in general was well aware of what was going on in the Smurl duplex. Most neighbors were helpful.
Even though they didn't really understand what was going on, and neither did we, of course, they were very supportive of our whole family,
Janet said. Jack, this is one way you find out who your true friends really are. Certainly we had neighbors who were skeptical, particularly at first, and we even had a few who hinted they might like to see us move. But in general, the neighbors talked with us about it and tried to come to some sort of peace with it. However understanding people were, though, the fact remained that the Smurls duplex remained under siege. Occurrences as various as the hissing of invisible snakes scaring the children and heavy footsteps thudding across the attic and a bedspread being shredded as if by a clawed beast continued to make the duplex a danger zone for habitation. The library. In the course of the siege, Janet Smurl decided she needed to become as much of an expert on the supernatural as possible. Daily, whatever the weather, whatever else she had to do, she went to the local library.
"They didn't have as many books on the subject as I'd have liked," Janet laughed. "But then who would have? When you really begin investigating the subject, you realize that while there's really a lot of literature on demonology, there still wasn't any sort of adequate explanation for what was happening to my family. As for the books themselves," Janet noted, "some of them were very serious. Others were really just sensational tales and weren't all that helpful. But one thing was for sure, I learned very quickly that we weren't the only people who'd ever been plagued by demons. There were several books that documented infestations similar to ours."
The entire family took comfort from Janet's reading.
"Knowing that the others had gone through the same thing and survived it gave us encouragement. Jack even joked at one point that maybe we should form some kind of club. That's one thing the press distorted later on. Through most of the days and nights, however bad they sometimes got, our family kept its faith and humor. Many of the incidents we'd laugh about."
Then Janet pauses.
"Of course, some of them were too frightening to laugh about."
At this point, Janet shakes her head soberly.
"During the heaviest part of my library visits, a very strange mist filled half of our room one night. I woke up and saw it, and tried to rouse Jack, but I couldn't. We learned later that he was in a deep psychic sleep. One, I guess, the thing had put him in. The mist stretched like a kind of webbing from our bed all the way out the window. In the moonlight, it had a very ghostly appearance. A few nights later, the same thing happened again, and this time, I did manage to get Jack awake. We watched as the mist swirled into a very strange shape, and suddenly we realized that it had drawn itself into the shape of a person. Then it moved quickly into the closet and was gone."
Janet found no reference to such a mist in any of the books she read. She did not sleep well for several nights. Two priests. During the worst part of that siege, two priests were invited to the Smurl duplex,
Father Sean Malone, a longtime family friend, came to have dinner one evening, and the Smurls told him about the problems they'd been experiencing. They were relieved to find that their friend took their words seriously.
Janet. Father Malone went upstairs, and then he told us that he realized he was in the presence of something evil. He said, "You're nice, normal people, and this shouldn't be happening to you."
As the priest talked, Janet could see that he had begun to sweat and was becoming very nervous.
We had the sense that the presence was applying pressure on Father Malone to leave our house.
Nonetheless, the priest went through the house, blessing each room and commanding the demon to leave these people alone. At one point, the pressure became so much on the priest, and he looked so shaken that Janet and Jack were afraid he might pass out. But Father Malone bravely finished the blessing, then had some coffee in the kitchen with the couple, and left. To their surprise and delight, the Smurls found that for the 3 days following the blessing, their home was untroubled by the demon. Several weeks later, the demon trying once again to dominate the Smurls, the couple called on Monsignor Hugh Brine to come bless the duplex. This followed an especially troubling incident in which Mary Smurl, whose health remained bad, found herself lifted, along with her mattress, so high in the air that she was forced to jump from the levitated bed, badly bruising her knees. Her husband, who was out playing cards, became angry when Mary related the story, and he helped Jack and Mary reach their decision to call the Monsignor.
Janet. Like Father Malone, the Monsignor went through the house and blessed each room with holy water. Again, we were dealing with a man who believed absolutely in what we told him. We learned later that not all church officials would be so cooperative.
Once again, they found that blessing the house kept the demon at bay for several days. Unfortunately, its return was signaled when closet doors began opening and banging shut at will. The Diary. Janet found a surprising number of sympathetic people with whom to discuss her problem. One such person was a university researcher who had spent most of his life investigating the paranormal. He suggested that the Smurls keep note of everything in a diary, which the family then proceeded to do. Jack. The diary gave us a record. It also showed us certain patterns, how things we did could cause it to appear again. We found out, for example, that if we were very upset about something, the entity would draw energy from us and use it against us. So we tried very hard to stay calm.
Janet.
It was during this period that we first talked of going public, of maybe calling a nearby TV station. But then we thought, if we went public, people would think that we were either crazy or making this up.
Fortunately, it was at this time that Janet received one of the most important phone calls of her life. A phone call. Janet liked standing in the sunny kitchen. Even though strange things had happened during the daylight, still there was something reassuring about the way golden beams washed over the spotless appliances and the clean floor and were trapped in the starched white curtains. This was January 1986, and the cold temperature outside only made Janet feel more secure inside. She had taken a break from her housework and was sitting in the kitchen, having a cup of coffee and a cigarette, when the phone rang. It was a friend of hers from just outside town. Tricia Larson.
Hi, Janet. How are things going?
Oh, you know, the usual.
Janet laughed.
Pots and pans flying around in the air, and demons hiding in our basement.
Tricia laughed appreciatively. Janet had confided virtually everything to her over the past year. Tricia had no trouble believing Janet's stories because Tricia had always had an interest in the occult and supernatural.
I may have some good news for you. Ed McMahon is sending us $10 million. Even better.
Seriously?
Seriously. I was reading this article last night about this professor at Marywood College in Scranton. He knows a lot about what the article calls demonic infestation. He may be able to help you.
Janet thought of Jack's skepticism about such people. You had to be very careful not to be used or exploited by people seeking money or publicity, or both.
He's a professor?
Yes, Tricia said.
I guess I should give him a call.
It sure couldn't hurt.
He doesn't sound...
Tricia laughed.
He sounds perfectly sane.
I'm going to do that, Tricia. And thanks for the information.
Good luck, Janet. I'll be saying a prayer for you. Virtually every day, Janet read about the subject of demonic infestation. Virtually every day, Janet sought help for her and her family by asking questions of those supposedly knowledgeable on such subjects. Finally, some good luck came her way when the same local professor told her about a couple named Ed and Lorraine Warren.
"They're professional psychic researchers," the professor said. "They've even been hired by the United States Army."
"Really?"
Janet felt thrilled and frightened at the same time. These people sounded perfect. But would they help the Smurls?
"Do you think they'd listen to us?"
"Oh, I'm sure they'd listen to you. But they're usually very busy, very much in demand. And the other thing is that before they take on a case, they go to great lengths to authenticate it." Janet smiled.
"If they spent an hour in our house, they'd know we're not trying to deceive anybody."
"I'm sure that's the case. Would you like the number?"
"Oh, very much. Very much."
He gave her the number. The Warrens. As demonologists, people who have devoted their lives to the study of demonic manifestations and infestations, Ed and Lorraine Warren are unequaled. Both presently in their early 60s, they have been married for more than 40 years. Ed is currently director of the New England Society for Psychic Research. His interest in the subject dates back to when the house he was raised in proved to be haunted. As a child, he witnessed objects flying around his house, and he even saw apparitions. Lorraine's experience with the paranormal also began at an early age. As a girl, she saw lights around people's heads. Later, she understood these lights to be auras. She had a similar experience when she met Ed.
"The night I was introduced to him, I saw a 16-year-old athletic young man standing in front of me. But then I flashed forward, glimpsed the future, and saw a heavier, graying man, and I knew this was Ed at a future date. I also knew that I would spend my entire life with him."
Ed and Lorraine met during World War II. Ed went to art school while Lorraine was a self-taught artist. They were married during the war on one of Ed's leaves. Their daughter, Judy, was born while Ed was still in the service. Later, they traveled around the countryside in a 33 Chevrolet Daisy with a German Shepherd in the back seat. They supported themselves by selling their paintings.
"We like to think of ourselves as the first hippies," Ed has said humorously. "But our interest in hauntings and demonology remained constant. We traveled all over New England. Whenever we heard of something peculiar happening, we'd drive over there and investigate," he added. "Over the years, we gathered a reputation as very serious students of such occurrences. Through all our exposure to demons, we also began to learn how to deal with them."
In recent years, the Warrens were involved in perhaps the most celebrated case of demonic infestation, Amityville. While they expressed displeasure with the fact that many things were exaggerated or left out of that book, they see the story of the Lutzes in Amityville as making believers of many former skeptics. The Warrens work only with ordained clergy in attempting to drive demons from homes.
"We work with every denomination, from priests and rabbis to ministers and even Muslims."
3 books have been written on the work of the Warrens: Deliver Us from Evil by Gerald Sawyer, The Devil in Connecticut by Gerald Brittle, and The Demonologist, also by Brittle. In addition, hundreds of articles and 2 TV shows of their own have further brought the Warrens to public attention. A few years ago, NBC made a TV movie based on one of the Warrens' cases. Even academia has beckoned. Ed and Lorraine have taught at Southern Connecticut State University.
"We have a single message we want to get across to the people, that there is a demonic underworld, and that on some occasions it can be a terrifying problem for people," Lorraine recently told a college audience.
One of their most notable assignments came when a general at West Point asked them to come in and deal with a haunting that had badly shaken up many cadets at the point in 1973. The Smurls could have no better helpmates than this dedicated team of demonologists. Ed Warren.
"The day we drove from Monroe, Connecticut to the Smurls' home in West Pittston, was overcast, with heavy dark clouds banked low on the horizon. We usually drive our van, and we did so that day, the wind gusts catching us on Interstate 84 and pushing the van around on long stretches of the concrete. I remember Diane Hayes, who was a librarian and a psychic who was a member of our research team, leaning forward and laughing about how the van was getting tossed around. Maybe I should have worn my crash helmet today. We pulled up to the Smurls' home around 1:30 that afternoon and just sat there, looking at it. When you've investigated more than 3,000 cases of the supernatural in the United States and Europe, you get a certain sense of houses, even from their exterior. So we sat as cars passed by, as people hurried by, huddled into their winter coats against the sharp wind, and we watched the duplex for a time. On the way over, we had discussed our phone conversations with the Smurls, and had pretty much sensed that there were signals here of a serious haunting. At least, we felt their phone calls warranted a serious investigation. Now I looked at both my wife and Diane. You getting anything?
Nothing in particular, Lorraine said. She is a trance medium with strong powers of clairvoyance and ESP.
Diane?
Me neither.
All right, let's go in then. The family that greeted us was not the sort we were used to seeing in hauntings. It was a classic pattern, troubled home life, great domestic anxiety, but right away we knew that this family did not fit that pattern. Jack Smurl was a strapping man, hearty and open. Janet Smurl was a friendly, soft-spoken person with luminous eyes and a ready smile. The children were neatly dressed, polite, attentive. Over coffee, we discussed the layout of the duplex, how each side had an attic, three bedrooms and a bathroom on the second floor, a living room and kitchen on the first floor, and a concrete cellar. There's a front porch and a back porch, and a two-car garage in the back. The property is enclosed by a chain-link fence. As we talked about ourselves, responding to various questions they had about us and how we worked, I saw a look of approval in the faces of Lorraine and Diane. They liked the Smurls, finding in them none of the frustration and anger we saw in so many families we worked with. The most obvious explanation for their relative calmness was their strong religious beliefs. Families who do not have God to rely on are often shattered by demonic experiences. Janet brought more coffee as the shadows grew deeper in the late afternoon. Then I pointed to the tape recorder I'd set up and said, "Now, when I first turn this on, you're going to feel a little self-conscious, but you'll get used to it. It's important that we interview you at length and then study the tapes later. All right?" Janet and Jack looked at each other, then they nodded, and I switched on the recorder. For the first part of the interview, Janet did much of the responding. "Are you familiar with the term Satanism?"
"Yes."
"What does it mean to you?"
"Worshipping Satan?"
"Yes." Pause. "Have you ever practiced Satanism?" Janet flushed.
"No."
"You know what a Ouija board is?"
"Yes."
"Have you ever experimented with one?"
"No."
"Has any member of your family ever experimented with one?"
"No."
"You certain?" Janet glanced around at her family.
"Yes, I'm certain.
Do you read books on witchcraft?"
"Since our problems started here, I've read every book I could on the subject."
"But you have not practiced any of the rituals in the books?"
"No."
"And your faith in God has remained intact?"
"If anything, it's stronger than ever."
"The same for you, Jack?"
"The same," Jack said.
Janet said nervously,
"I just wonder why you're asking these questions."
"Because," I explained, "it's amazing how many cases we've discovered where people have accidentally brought spirits into their houses by their interest in supernatural rites. For instance, we knew of a 25-year-old woman who had a doll that was moving around by itself. The woman made the mistake of calling in a medium for a seance. During the seance, a spirit spoke and said it was the ghost of a dead little girl, and it asked for permission to reside in the doll. The doll's owner gave the spirit permission,
But in the days that followed, she began to very much regret what she'd done, because the doll tried to possess people in the house, and even clawed and cut one person. The spirit was finally exorcised from the house when an Episcopal priest performed an exorcism. What happened is that the doll's owner made some major errors. She gave the spirit recognition, and then she gave it permission to come into the house. Lorraine shared another story with the Smurls that afternoon.
There was this very attractive, very intelligent 19-year-old woman who liked to dabble in anything that gave her kicks. One day, she bought a Ouija board and began playing with it. Then suddenly, she found herself communicating with a spirit that managed to flatter the young woman into letting it come into her home. As usual, at first, the spirit was a polite house guest, and the young woman was thrilled that through the Ouija board she'd discovered the ultimate kick. But very abruptly, things changed. The spirit started fires, rampaged through rooms, and tried to physically harm the young woman's family. Finally, a Catholic priest we know had to be called in to perform an exorcism, and ultimately, the spirit was driven out.
That's why it's so important, I explained, not to dabble in the black arts, and that's why we have to ask these questions.
Then I turned to Lorraine and said, while I'm completing the interview, why don't you two take a tour of the house?
Lorraine and Diane's combined psychic abilities are formidable enough one at a time. Together, they can turn up amazing truths no other process seems able to. While Lorraine and Diane excused themselves, I went back to completing our profile of the Smurl family.
A Violent Spirit. On the way up the stairs, Diane paused and closed her eyes and held her fingertips to her head.
My Lord, she said.
Lorraine, preceding her friend up the stairs, turned around. She knew what Diane was responding to. She had already sensed it too, the unmistakable air of evil that lay like a gray pall over the entire house. Diane put a hand to her chest, tried for a kind of half-grin.
You know what?
What?
I'm scared. I didn't think I would be, but...
Lorraine touched Diane's arm. It's all right. We get scared, too.
You and Ed?
Lorraine nodded.
It never gets easy, Diane.
Then she smiled. Unfortunately.
Did you hear something?
Diane asked.
I think so.
I'm not sure. Diane's fingers trembled.
I was sure I did.
They stood outside the last bedroom. The door was closed. All the other rooms had been checked out and found to be empty. But a few moments earlier, coming down the hall, there had been a noise in this room, beyond the door.
Well, we may as well go in,
Lorraine said.
Yes, may as well,
Diane said, though she did not sound too sure of what she was doing. Lorraine extended her hand, turned the knob, eased the door open. A sweet-smelling sachet was on the air, as were the rich scents of other cosmetics. Late afternoon light cast long shadows across the wide double bed in the bureau. The wood in the old house creaked in the heart-pounding silence. Lorraine stepped across the threshold, keeping her eyes moving for sight of anything suspicious. Her sensitivity as a psychic allows her to see the merest traces of the spirit world. Diane followed Lorraine into the room, keeping close. Lorraine knelt down by the bed, lifted the colorful comforter and looked under it with a flashlight she kept in the pocket of her jacket. Nothing. Next, she looked behind a straight-backed chair and then behind the bureau. Still nothing. There was only one place left, and Diane had been staring at it anxiously for several minutes. The closet.
Are we going to look inside?
Diane said.
Yes, I've got a suspicion we'll find something there. I'm not even sure why.
With that, Lorraine moved to the closet door, steadied herself, and then flung it wide open, pushing the stark yellow beam of her flashlight inside immediately. As the two women peered into the gloom of the closet, Lorraine's heart seemed to be lodged somewhere in her throat, and a fine sheen of perspiration appeared on her forehead. No matter how many times you encounter the satanic underworld, it is always frightening.
Smell it. Yes, Diane said. Demons.
The fourth one.
And the worst one?
Lorraine stood completely still now, and forced her eyes closed so tightly a headache threatened. One of her psychic gifts was the ability to picture the invisible spirits that had infested a house. Diane watched her.
Are you getting any sort of reading?
Lorraine was.
I'm afraid for them,
she said in a troubled voice.
What do you see?
Previously, they had discovered three spirits in the house and had psychic profiles of them. One of them had been angry, but with prayer and perseverance could be handled. This fourth one, however, was another matter.
A demon, Lorraine said softly. A genuine one.
When she spoke at these times, her voice had the slightly dulled quality of someone in a trance.
Do you think that's the one that's causing the problems?
Lorraine, still trapped inside her psychic vision, nodded. Diane blessed herself and then said a quick prayer that Lorraine would not be overwhelmed by the image filling her mind. They were standing in the center of a tidy, middle-class bedroom, dust